Accession number 26934, Reel 3.
So, when I was coming down to land in a glider, my glasses would steam up because they'd become cold up at 1,000 feet, and as you came down in the warmer, damp air, their condensation formed on them and couldn't see properly. So I had to cure this by borrowing the cloth from my gas mask and wiping it with the gas mask clear cloth, and that cured my problems. You can also do it by using a potato cut in half, I learned later, when I used to go to the open air cinema in Nairobi. But the gliding, I carried on with the gliding, and then after a while I did graduate to a proper glider called a Grumo Baby, which gave proper gliding. I think the maximum period I had in the air was 20 minutes, which was not bad really, looking for thermals and things like that. The only problem was that at Lüneburg, the Russian border or frontier was only 8 miles away, and it was 8 miles downwind. So you had to be a bit careful about how you carried on in your glider, because Bruno babies are no match for MiGs. At that time, I think my pay was £21 a month, and the gliding cost 2 and 6 pence a launch. That's 25p. I think nowadays it costs you £25. About June 52, the Scots Greys left Lüneburg, and I was transferred to another company in Lüneburg, the 109 Company Royal Army Service Corps, where it was a smaller LAD. But we had a very lovely officer's mess, which was in a requisition doctor's house in the town. Beautiful place. And being a captain then, I was a senior officer in the mess. All the other senior officers were married and living out, so I was more or less in charge of the mess. And there were about four subalterns in there. So we had a very enjoyable time there. We were looking after soft skin vehicles only, really, and they were not much used. So we spent our time prettying them up, really. I remember the drop arm on the steering always had to be polished to make sure you could see a crack in it. That's an arm between the steering wheel and the track rods. It was that about 8 inches long, had to be polished, down to the metal and polished, so you could see if it was cracked. We thought that was rather strange. And the wheel nuts were always different colours. I think the green nuts, no, the yellow nuts held the wheel on, and the red nuts held the wheel, two halves of the wheel together. You see, I think you see that on army vehicles now. And that went on the LAD there. We had a very good sergeant major, who, quartermaster sergeant, who really ran the LAD. And in fact, it was an easy life for me because I just had to sign papers and things like that and wander around flicking a stick against my leg, which is made me feel important. It was a good time. I do remember I had to sign a paper every month to certify that I had done certain things, like ensure all the men had changed their underclothes regularly and had cut their toenails regularly. And I mean, a bit like the sort of nanny state we've got into nowadays, really. Of course, we never did it. We just signed the paper and sent it in.
What was morale like?
Not bad. Pretty good, really. But it was mostly national service then, and a lot of the people didn't really want to be there, you know, and they were wanted to go home. We had a bit of problems time to time with drunkenness in the local town. The soldiers getting drunk coming in could be a bit difficult when you're an orderly officer and having to deal with all this coming in. There was the officer's mess kept one sword, which was passed on from orderly officer to orderly officer. So when orderly officer had to wear service dress and a sambrown and a sword, so you inherited the sword. I never found out what happened to my father's sword, so I never had one of my own. Although I did have his sambrown belt, but I don't know where that's gone now. Anyway, about June 1953, I was appointed Divisional Inspector of Equipment. So I went to 7th Armour Division HQ, and I was given a team of inspectors, and I went round all the regiments in the division inspecting their equipment, radios, guns, tanks, the whole lot. So I had specialists in each discipline, with a sergeant in charge of each discipline and a crew of men to do the inspections. They prepared inspection reports. I had to go and liaise with the officer in charge of the CO of the regiment. I used to arrange it in advance, go there a few days beforehand, arrange it all with him. Of course, I always got a cordial reception because I had to write a report afterwards. So it doesn't matter where I went, they treated me well. And then correlate all these inspection reports for all this equipment and put a sort of percentage score against it all, and then write a report which went to the CO and to the general. So it was a quite a powerful position, really. But and I was quite well treated in many of the places. I remember in the mess of the 11th Hussars at Hona, just near Hanover, the party after dinner for the officers in mess was, they had a beautiful dining hall with a minstrel's gallery. This was an old Luftwaffe place. And there was an enormous table, I think a mahogany table, about 6 foot wide and, I don't know, about 20 foot long, down the middle of the room with chairs. And these chaps, of course, wore spurs, the 11th Hussars. And they would go, after dinner, they would go round up into the minstrel's gallery and jump onto the table. And then they'd all, everybody having jumped, they'd move the table a foot further away from the gallery and do it again. And they'd keep doing that until the last chap got on the table. All the others, of course, hit the edge of it as they came down and sustained various injuries. But, you know, that's what they used to do. Quite wild mess parties sometimes, really. We used to play mess cricket. That's right. You put a table down and you bounced a cricket ball off it to each other. You threw a cricket ball on the table. One bounce and the fellow the other end had to catch it. Now that could get a bit vicious too. Then some of the lads one day, I remember this was in 109 Company RSC, the Sergeant Major was entertained in the mess one night, and he came in his, he had a German car by then, his own car, and they chained the back axle to a lamppost, and when he tried to drive off, he couldn't. That sort of activity went on all the time. Just boys being boys, you know, really.
What was your relationship like with your NCOs?
Oh, very good. I always had an enjoyable relationship with the NCOs. I didn't really like the evaluation forms that you have to do at the end of each, you know, periodically on your people. Because I found, and I've since found in industry, that these things are like a declaration of war. Much better to say to a chap, look, your boots are not clean, than put on a piece of paper, this man's boots are dirty. Because once it's written, it goes on his records, it's in tablets and stone, and they loathe it. And the sense of injustice is there. Whereas if you say it to the fella, you get somewhere. And I found that was a bad thing. And I've since found the same thing in industry. And, when the personnel departments introduce their assessment forms, I always think it's a backward move. But anyway, there you are, old-fashioned. So the trouble with that job, well, we saw a lot of interesting equipment. One of the things that fascinated me, I've always been interested in aircraft. That's how I come to be flying. In fact, I would have been in the Air Force, but for poor eyesight. My brother was a fighter pilot, and he was stationed in Germany at the same time, flying Vampires. But they had the Royal Horse Artillery regiments were equipped with self-propelled 25-pounder guns, which consisted of a standard 25-pounder gun mounted on a Sherman tank chassis with an open top. And these things, the engines on the ones 4th RHA had, I think, were Wright Cyclone radial engines, very, very similar to the one used by Lindbergh when he flew the Atlantic in 1928. Big radial engine with air-cooled, and if you started the engine without draining the bottom cylinder, the oil in there would bang the head off the cylinder and cause endless trouble. But I think they made these tanks with all sorts of different engines. Wherever they could get them, they stuck in Chrysler car engines and goodness knows what. That was all during the war, of course. But the problem with the inspectorate job was, of course, it was a stress job, really. And as by the nature of it, it was a stress job. And I got fed up with it because, for one thing, laundry was an enormous problem. If you're moving every 4 days, it's very difficult to keep ahead of your laundry. Some regiments can do it for you and get it for you done in the officer's mess. Others can't. You have to do it yourself, and you get back to the divisional HQ at the weekends, which is only a day and a half, you know. So it was a problem, really. And of course, you're always on the move. You're never in one place. Divisional headquarters mess was stiff. Not like a regimental mess at all, because people were changing. They didn't have any common ground. It was at Verden, I think. The mess was at Verden in Germany. There was nothing much in the local town, and life was not very good, really. It was always around different regiments. And when my time was up, the 4-year short service commission I started on expired in February 1954. The question of a permanent commission came up, but I decided not to go for that because I thought I'd give civilian, having been with the army now for 8 years, sort of this way and that way, I decided to give civilian life a whirl. And I was, I came here to Arborfield and relinquished my commission on the 18th of February 1954. And that was the end of my army career. I went on the reserve, but I was never called again.
So how did you feel it? Did you find it easy going back into City Street?
Well, not really, because I took a job then in London with British American Tobacco, as it happened. And of course, tobacco wasn't a bad name in those days. It was all right. And we all smoked. Even your doctor smoked. And if they thought it was an antiseptic. So I took a job with British American Tobacco at their head office in London. And I was living then at home in Morden because I was still single at that time. And I was commuting up to London, sometimes an old banger of a car I had, sometimes on the tube. And it was a pretty dismal life after the army. And in fact, after a couple of years of it, I went off to Africa. So I didn't stand it for long.